No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote.
Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People the Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show which will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's last colony. Along with my co-host, Maria Sanchez, we hope our show will start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important to you and affect the lives of all of us. So join in the conversation by calling in at 888-628-6008, or you can Skype questions to BBSRADIO and the number one. Tonight, we have a very exciting guest. We have two exciting things going on tonight. Maria's back after a week hiatus, and we also have with us Dr. Sherry Towers. Dr. Towers has a diverse background in mathematical and computational modeling, applied statistics, informatics, advanced quantitative methods, high performance computing, and data mining. She has over 360, sorry for that interference, folks. She has over 360 publications on a wide variety of topics that include applied statistics and mathematical and computational epidemiology and sociology. Her work in computational sociology has received international media attention, including an analysis of how media can incite panic in populations and how contagion may play a role in temporal patterns observed in mass killings in the U.S. And that's what we're here to talk about tonight. Dr. Towers, are you there? Thanks so much.
Hi, Michael. Glad to be back.
I'm sorry. I didn't give you a proper welcome back, Maria. We're glad to have you back. And we have
an honor, Sherry, to be here.
We have Sherry Towers with us tonight. And I'm just so excited to have her on the show because I think this is such an important part of the puzzle. Dr. Towers, are you there?
Yes, I am. Thank you for having me.
Yeah. Oh, well, thanks so much for being on the show. And as I discussed with you just prior to the show, you and I, and I believe Maria as well, we're all brought up around guns. And for years, I've as much of a gun control advocate as I am, I know there's another part of the puzzle that's missing because these things didn't go on when I was in high school, and there were plenty of guns available. And I think you have an important part of the puzzle, and so it's great for you to come here tonight and talk to us about it. Why don't you start off? What can you tell us about these ideas that gun violence, especially mass violence, may be like a virus? It may be contagious.
So what we found in our research was when we looked at the time patterns in mass killings and school shootings that have occurred in the U.S., what we saw was that there was unusual bunching together in time of these events, and that's kind of a hallmark of contagion. And actually what we did was we fit a mathematical model of contagion to the data, and it confirmed that indeed there's significant evidence of contagion in these things happening. So it appears that when one of these events happens, particularly ones that get widespread, like national or international media coverage, it seems to, what we hypothesize is happening is it's planting the idea in the mind of people who are already at risk to do these things. It's not like just a random general person in the population who is being ideated with these. I mean, these are people who already were likely fantasizing about committing these acts already. And what appears to happen is that sometimes these events actually will appear to basically be the trigger that causes already vulnerable people to go out and perpetrate a like act. And this copycat effect has been suspected for a long time. What was unique about our analysis was that we were the first to quantify it.
And how did you quantify it? How did you go about gathering the information? I love quantifying because it's so different than qualifying.
So the actual inspiration for the analysis, because we do in our research center, we do a lot of modeling of diseases and biological populations, amongst other things. And the nucleus for the idea of this analysis actually came from something that happened in my own life. I was actually at Purdue University, and I was going to meet with some collaborators that I had been working with there at the time. And the meeting was canceled because there was a shooting on campus that day. A student walked into a classroom at the school, shot another student dead, and then walked out and waited for the police to arrest him. And that day, it occurred to me that that was the third school shooting I had heard about in approximately a 10-day period, which even for the U.S., which is known to have a serious problem compared to other developed countries, that seemed like a large number to be happening in an awfully short period of time. And that's what led me to wonder whether or not there was indeed some sort of significant contagion effect at play. So I talked to my colleagues about it, about whether we should approach this from a mathematical modeling perspective that we would normally apply to diseases. And what we did is we got some data. USA Today has a wonderful database that they maintain to this day of mass killings. We also received from the Brady campaign was very kind and gave us their data on school shootings. Sorry, and they also gave us data on mass shootings where there was at least three people shot, not necessarily killed. And these happen very frequently in the U.S., much more frequently than most Americans realize. So when there's a low casualty count, low number of people killed, but there might be three people shot, those happen so frequently that they rarely make it past the local news, because otherwise we would just basically be bombarded, on the national news with news about these incidents happening. And they tend to be things, events like that tend to be things like gang violence or people shooting up a bar or domestic arguments, things of that nature tend to be what those things are. Not generally like a public mass killing where somebody walks into a movie theater and starts shooting people. And so with those three sources of data, we fit our contagion model to each separately. And we found significant evidence of contagion in both the mass killing and the school shootings, but not the much more frequent low casualty count mass shootings. So it showed no evidence of contagion. And it was from that we surmised that widespread media attention appears to be playing a role in the dynamics that we're seeing.
And I would argue that it has more to do with the relationship or lack thereof. In other words, the unreported ones are intimate relationships, whereas the mass shootings or the school shootings are strangers.
And how do you mean? Like, as far as contagion is concerned? I don't understand your question.
That you're suggesting that the mass shootings and the school shootings are being promulgated because of the media exposure, and the other ones aren't because they have lower victim levels. But I'm suggesting, and this might be a caveat for your research, that it has to do with the interpersonal relationship. You have
a
smaller number.
Well, clearly all of these have some kind of personal relationship. So when we looked at the mass killings, that included family mass killings. So there are, unfortunately, roughly 50% if not even the slim majority of mass killings in the U.S. where there's at least four people killed, are actually family mass killings where someone has exterminated their entire family. And then a lesser fraction of those are actually what we would call public mass killings, where they're somewhat random. And it is true that school shootings tends to be people that the perpetrator knows, or at least knows peripherally. So certainly the person who shot up the high school, this most recent incident, didn't necessarily know all of his victims. Certainly they were at the school, same school as he was, but they were all different grades, and it's unclear whether he actually personally knew them. They just happened to be there at the school. So, what your point has some merit in that there is more to this than just the media playing a role. And certainly what we also saw in our study was when we looked at the state rates, the state per capita rates of these kinds of tragedies, and we looked at state rates of mental illness, state prevalence of mental illness, and state prevalence of firearm ownership, we found that mental illness was not correlated to the state rates of these tragedies, but firearm ownership was, prevalence of firearm ownership was. And so clearly it's a multifaceted problem that you can't just look at it from one direction, and that is the be-all, end-all of what is causing the U.S. to have more of a problem with these kinds of tragedies than any other developed country per capita. So I think that what is needed is a great deal more research, but the problem is that Congress currently has a moratorium on federal funding for firearm violence research, and that's been put in place since 1996. It was called the Dickey Amendment.
I just read that at the end of last week. And Michael, can you speak to that?
Well, let me first say, just to put in perspective what Dr. Towers is talking about in terms of frequency, every 17 minutes, someone's killed with a gun. And there's been 8 school shootings since the beginning of the year, and we're only in February. So this is a massive problem. And yes, I can speak to the moratorium in the sense that the National Rifle Association just scares the hell out of politicians. They have a lot of money and they have a lot of clout because they have a very, very active bunch of people behind them. You know, they push themselves as an activist group. They're really an industrial, they're really an industry lobbyist who's out to sell more guns. But the people that stand behind them are very, very adamant, and they vote. So Congress very often backs up in the face of opposition from the NRA. I think we're seeing one thing that we're seeing right now, which is unusual, is we have several Republicans in states where guns are important coming out and against the NRA, and a lot of businesses backing off. This may be a new age as far as this goes, and I think that what Dr. Towers is talking about may be at the forefront. You know, this may be one of the issues that Congress deals with immediately, is refunding more research. I mean, I think obviously they have to do it, and this would be something that they could do. I think they could do and get past the NRA.
What's interesting is that Jay Dickey, he has since passed away, the day before the San Bernardino shooting had written to Congress and told them that he now regrets that he had basically sponsored this bill, because he felt that if there had been firearm violence research that had happened over the previous 20 years, that the U.S. would not currently have the problem that it does now. And then, of course, the San Bernardino massacre happened, and the day after the San Bernardino massacre, despite the fact that Jay Dickey had written that letter, and despite the fact the San Bernardino massacre had occurred, Congress voted once again to continue the moratorium. And so it means that people like myself, I don't get paid to do the kind of research I do. I have to do it as a as a sidebar to the other research I do, for instance, involving modeling diseases. So it's very difficult to keep up a cohesive research program because you can't afford to pay graduate students or postdoctoral research associates or buy the materials that you need in order to do the research, such as computing equipment. It is astonishing to me that this is one of the very few research endeavors that you cannot get federal funding for.
That's amazing. And, you know, if you look at one of the facts that you just put out there, Doctor, that firearm ownership could be a predictor. I know that I've read, I can't remember exactly what the statistics are, but the mass amount of guns that are owned in the district, in America, are owned by a very few people. I can't remember what the statistic is, like 10% or 90% or something like that.
currently, the average firearm owner in the U.S. owns 10 firearms.
Yeah.
So if you are a firearm owner, on average, you own 10 firearms. So the firearm ownership over time, household firearm ownership, has slowly kind of been going down. It's kind of plateaued. But the number of firearms, particularly in the wake of these tragedies, firearm sales tend to skyrocket. And so the number of firearms is going up, but the fraction of the population that owns them has been slowly going down and kind of plateauing. And so it really has, the number of firearms per firearm owner has really exploded in the last, 10, 15 years.
So I've done research this week on the NRA because, Michael, as you mentioned in the introduction, my dad was a proud card-carrying member, and I can't tell you how many firearms he had. I grew up with guns everywhere, hanging on the wall and under his desk and, from shotguns and rifles. And so, of course, no assault rifles, but so I thought, what's the genesis of this? So the NRA originally started out as an organization to help make people more efficient with their use of the firearm. One of the founders said that that people couldn't hit the side of a barn. That's how, and he thought that was irresponsible. If you owned a gun, you should be able to shoot it properly. And most people owned guns to protect property and to hunt, right? So then it got co-opted in the early part of the 1900s politically, when the firearm somehow control started. And what I don't understand, though, and Dr. Towers, maybe you can speak to this, is why it went from this innocent kind of let's make this a sport that has accountability to politics and the Second Amendment.
Well,
so one of the things that I grew up in Canada. I'm dual Canadian American, and I spent my entire childhood and young adult life in Canada, and I've been living in the U.S. for the last 20 years. And I grew up with guns in Canada. Basically, where I grew up was basically a wilderness area. Pretty much everybody hunted. Certainly, my family hunted. And I think that there is, looking at the Canadian experience versus the American experience and the attitude towards firearms in the two different countries, the Revolutionary War was really key in how basically firearms play a role in American attitude towards firearms in their society. Whereas Canada never had a Revolutionary War. And so in that sense, we don't see in Canada, firearms as being kind of a tied up with our national identity, if you know what I'm saying. And in America, that's certainly very strong, how firearms really are tied into, like they were key in how America came to be a country. If they had not been able to come to arms to basically rise up against the British, America would not be a country. It would still be a British colony. So I think that that's one of the primary differences that I see between the two countries. And it means that in Canada, when Canada has imposed things like magazine capacity, because you can certainly buy firearms in Canada, this idea that Canada has such strict gun control that no one has firearms is completely untrue. You know, lots of people have firearms in Canada. But what Canada has is a strict magazine capacity law. So, and which is, there's only a few states that have such laws. And so basically, pretty much anywhere you'd want to go in America, you can get high capacity firearms. And that, they have become much more popular over the past 10 to 15 years than they were before. So even people who might have grown up in households that had firearms, they likely did not have high capacity firearms with capacity magazines. They probably had perhaps handguns, pistols, shotgun, a hunting rifle, but not like an AR-15. And those things like AR-15s have exploded in popularity in recent years. And that, I think, is one of the big differences in the changes that we're seeing in American society.
And, the NRA co-opted. This is, I agree with the doctor 100% about this. They plugged into this thing that it's part of our national identity, and they morphed it. They focus on the last four words of the Second Amendment, which is shall not be infringed, but they forget the first three words, a well-regulated. This was meant to be, the Second Amendment was meant to for people to have guns so they could protect the government. But certainly the NRA pushes the idea that you should have a gun to protect yourself from the government. And a lot of these people, I think, that have so many guns have this feeling that they need to protect themselves, that it's a matter of liberty, that, you know, we see slogans like "Don't tread on me," and you know, from the Revolutionary War, used to promulgate the idea that you need a gun in case the government comes to get you. And we saw LaPierre say this just the other day. He was standing up there saying, they're trying to take away your Second Amendment. The president was saying the same thing. We're not going to let them take away your Second Amendment. So I think what you said, Doctor, is just hit the nail right on the head. The NRA has played on this thing that it's part of our national identity to be armed. And I think, you know, that's what's happened, Maria, that they co-opted the movement because they realized that there was a lot of, well, I don't know any other way to put it, there's a lot of money in it.
But to be armed and to shoot and kill are two different things.
Absolutely. And that's why we need people like Dr. Towers, because there is something more than just guns, right? As you just pointed out, Dr. Towers.
Well, and this Nicholas Cruz had his gun for over a year.
Yeah.
So, yeah. I mean, it's not like he rushed out in a fever. And that's where I think mental health comes into play. Because no sane, healthy person takes their own life or takes the lives of others.
So I think what has to be realized, because I certainly have been asked, whenever one of these tragedies occurs, I get asked to do many interviews to the media. And one of the things that there's various talking points that often are put forward. One of them is mental health. The other is things like violent movies, violent video games. One of the things that I can tell you is that Canadian kids play just as many violent video games as American kids, watch the same violent movies. And mental health, the prevalence of mental illness in Canada is pretty much the same as it is in the U.S. So the differences between the, yet the Canada has just a fraction per capita the number of mass killings that the U.S. does. And so it's not just mental health. It's not just, you know, violent video games or violent movies. When you look to what the real differences are between the countries, and it's not even just the prevalence of firearm ownership, things like magazine capacity laws are really one of the fundamental differences between how Canada and the U.S. differ when it comes to guns. And I really think that that has an impact on why Canada, really this is much less of a problem in Canada than it is in the U.S.
Well, and you know, you've already said, Doctor, that some people are more susceptible to these things, but that would be true of a virus as well, right? That if you had something like Ebola or AIDS, there are people that are more susceptible to it.
Absolutely. And so when we look at, so the FBI has stages of active shooter incidents where basically they've broken it down where the first kind of stages are the person is fantasizing about it, and then they move on to planning and preparation. And so, of course, the fantasizing stage is where mental health, access to mental health treatment comes in, where you can start treating the person at that stage where they're starting to show signs of mental illness and basically prevent them from, you know, getting to the point where they really are planning on actually committing, you know, a horrific act. So as they move on to planning and preparation, that's where they start doing things like buying firearms, buying ammunition, planning out how they're going to do it. And that's, of course, where various aspects of gun control may help. The last stages are approach and implementation. So this is where the perpetrator is basically approaching the venue where they're going to commit the act, and implementation is where they start firing. And this is where the idea of a good guy with a gun or arming the teachers, that's kind of like that last fail-safe in that entire stage of contagion that can potentially stop the incident or lower the casualty count. What we know from modeling of our background in modeling diseases is that the earlier in the infection stage that you can basically intervene in the spread of infection, like as the person is, you know, moving through the stages of infection, the better the outcome in reducing the size of the epidemic. So relying on, so there may be a point when people say, we don't know, we haven't quantified it, but there may be a point when people say, well, if you arm, you know, if you have an armed society, that will intervene in that last stage. There may be a point, but the problem is if you have free arms for society, it unfortunately, and you have complete lack of gun control, any kind of restrictions, it unfortunately doesn't impede in the planning and preparation stage of people who are, you know, planning on doing these kinds of things. And so there is, it's really multifaceted dynamics that go into these things, but I can tell you from our experience in modeling diseases, basically hedging all your bets on intervening in that last final stage is really not going to give you an optimal outcome in controlling things.
Too much, well, too little, too late.
Yeah. Yes. Well, let's talk about Maria's favorite subject for a moment, the media. let's talk about how the media's role in this, doctor, because, you know, that seems to be central to the kind of research you're doing. What can we do? What can the media do, number one? And number two, do we see what's going on now on Twitter, for example, with the survivors of the Stoneman Douglas High School thing? Is that an anecdote? Is that an antidote to this? Is there now a push? Does pushback on Twitter and other social media, does that help in any way?
That's a huge question.
It is a huge question.
And I would argue, before you even answer, Dr. Towers, because I'm getting my PhD in media psychology, that mm-hmm. the media wouldn't be doing what they're doing unless there weren't consumers.
Thank you.
Because they are profit-driven.
I have brought this up in so many interviews where I'm asked, should the media have basically have restrictions on how it can cover these events? And what I always say is that the media has First Amendment rights to publish what it sees fit. But the reason that the media publishes these stories, and from what I've heard from a bunch of different reporters I've talked to, is that by far these stories are the ones that get the most hits, for instance, an online story. By far, like compared to any other topic that they could be writing about, these stories
get the shares and the retweets and the.
Exactly. And so what is driving this? The media, what people have to realize is that by and large, media are private companies that are supplying a product to consumer to meet consumer demand. And so if a media company was to decide that they're going to dial back their coverage, you know, try to have less sensational coverage, for instance, of these tragedies, they are just going to lose that, because what's driving this is the public's thirst for those stories. Right. And it's almost lurid, actually, I mean, at some level, it's information seeking, because as a society, we always want to understand why these tragedies happen. But especially as you move, you know, a few days away from you know, the incident occurs, and usually in the first day or two, the stories are primarily about, you know, trying to understand why this happened. So details about the tragedy, perhaps some details about the perpetrator. But then I've noticed as you, particularly once you get past that first 24 hours, the stories tend to get a more of a lurid bent to it. And certainly the purpose of those stories becomes questionable, other than to act as essentially some kind of entertainment. And I think it's very unfortunate. And so what drives this media coverage is not the media themselves. I mean, if the media was to start publishing stories about, I don't know, you know, something that the public completely wasn't interested in, even if the media was to flood the airwaves with those stories, the public's not going to be interested. So it is the public interest that's driving this. And we as society need to look at ourselves and ask ourselves, are we reading a particular story because we really are looking for new, you know, information to try to understand why this happened? Or has this become almost, unfortunately, to put it this way, almost entertainment? And I think if it bleeds, it leads. And it's always been this way.
Right.
And unfortunately, it is something we have to. But one thing that has been that has been pointed out to me is that certainly in this day and age of social media, where the majority of Americans actually get their news through social media, links that they see in social media, that we can, if we can get some introspection as a society before we retweet something or share a story on social media, are we sharing this because it is actually information that we believe that our friends and followers need to know? Or are we sharing it is because it's somehow, you know, more goes towards the lurid entertainment side of things? And so I think that it's been pointed out that we as a society, if we are introspective enough, can dial back, purposely dial back on what we choose to share and only share things that are more towards the informational side of things.
Well, and so do we need to educate our population about this? Is that
so it's called media literacy? I just have been studying this all week, and unfortunately, it doesn't work. And I don't know, Dr. Towers, if you will agree with me, because there's tribalism, which is why we share, because we exist in these silos and we find what we look for. Mm-hmm. And there's the media literacy, which is what Dr. Towers was suggesting, is thinking about it, have introspection, have impulse control. Why do we want to let this out, et cetera? And some of the social media companies are apparently putting in algorithms that say a third party has vetted the story and it's been found to be false. Do you still want to share it? And that may and may not help shape fake news and the sharing thereof.
Maybe. So one of the things that we looked at last year was related to the 2016 election. Is we wanted to look at, from a contagion perspective, how contagious fake news is compared to news that points out that the fake news is fake. Does that make sense? So basically, tweets where they're retweeting fake news articles, fake news in general, and then tweets that are pointing to the fact that that tweet is fake news. So it turns out that fake news is so infectious, and debunking news, let's call it the debunking news, is so not infectious that we couldn't even quantify the difference, because the debunking news basically doesn't even catch on. Like, you'll see a tweet that's basically debunking it and might get a few retweets, but then just quickly dies off. And so what was almost scary is how infectious fake news is. And a large part of it comes into what you were talking about, where we like information that fits our worldview. And so that tends to be information that we would share with our friends. And so oftentimes it's something comes across our news feed that already kind of fits in with what our worldview is. That's the kind of thing that we'll automatically put faith in, even if it's fake. Like, we will not go and try to, you know, do any kind of fact checking.
Right.
And so I myself as a scientist tend to do a lot of fact checking of stuff I see on social media. And even occasionally I am fooled by something that turns out to be fake. But I think that the average American does not do that, and it's unfortunate. It would be nice if it was something they taught in schools, actually.
Well, which is where that social media literacy that, Michael, you were alluding to would help, but it's been proven to not help thus far. Because aren't you speaking about the comprehension bias?
Feeds into it. So comprehension bias is part of it.
We seek to get validated of what we already know.
Yes, exactly. And then you accept it as being true.
Right.
Right. And I can speak to that. I can tell you that I never go out and quote a statistic in public that in a public a forum where somebody doesn't stand up and give me some anecdotal information. You know what I mean? Everybody says, yes. Oh, yeah. I know there's a lot of guns, but my cousin had somebody broke into their house and he defended himself or whatever it is, you know, and so, yeah, that's a very, very strong factor, I believe. But, Doctor, can I ask you about the contagion period? There seems to be in your research a period in which these things become contagious, and then the interest in them wanes. Is there something in your research that can you know, put out predictive models on what these periods are, and is there some, you know, policy thing that we can do to mitigate their impact?
So what we found was that the, and this is fitting separately to the mass killings and the school shootings, so for both of them fit separately, we found that the average length of the contagious period was about 13 days. Which was interesting, right? Like, that was very intriguing to us, that from two different samples, we found basically the same, you know, we estimated the same length of the contagious period. And what we find really interesting is that that's about the same length of time that media coverage is paid to these high-profile events. So here we are the week after the incident in Florida, over a week after, and we're talking about it. And so there's still being media attention paid to that, but it is dropping off in time as people move on to other things. And so this is also feeds into that, you know, it very well may be the media attention playing a role in actually acting as the vector of the contagion. But one thing that we were thinking of looking at, I think this particular incident probably has been anomalous in that respect, is that our feeling is, although we have yet to quantify it, that there seems to be the period that's spent paying media attention to these things seems to be getting shorter. So we have yet to do like a full analysis to quantify that. That's just our sense, you know, over the past years. But certainly this particular incident, there seems to be prolonged media attention being paid to it, in part because of the advocacy groups being formed by the survivors and the victims' families, where they're organizing marches, for instance, to happen next month. And so the media attention for this particular event seems to be more prolonged and of a different type than what we've seen before.
So is that counterproductive? Is that counterproductive? They're expecting 500,000 people here in Washington next month for this protest. Do you see that as counterproductive because it keeps this in front of the media?
Counterproductive?
No, absolutely
how?
Not at all. One of the things that actually, no, I don't find it counterproductive at all. One of the things that is interesting about this latest incident was that the stories about the advocacy of the victims actually pushed aside a lot of the stories that you would normally see focusing on the perpetrator. And so there were far fewer this time around, my sense was, just, you know, following the news, far fewer stories really, really delving into the perpetrator, and a lot more media attention was paid to the victims' families and the survivors. So I don't find that counterproductive at all. I actually found it refreshing. And while I have no way to quantify it, because this is the first time it really happened, my sense is that when you think about the contagion effect, when the perpetrator is now taken back seat to the media coverage, you know, the details of the perpetrator, I think that that is likely to have a beneficial effect when it comes to reducing the contagion effect, because it's much less glorification of the perpetrator and more focus on the victims and the survivors.
So is there something we can do in media to make sure, you know, something from a policy standpoint that we can do to make sure that those stories get out in the media? Is there anything?
The survivors and the victims?
Yeah, exactly. Or is that just a matter of interest?
I think what's different here is that in the past, you know, there's always tends to be some stories that, you know, particularly in a high-profile incident where a governmental dignitary like the president or vice president, for instance, will go to the funerals, and you know, there'll be media stories covering the funerals and, you know, showing, you know, victim families and whatnot, mourning victim families. And there has been some coverage, but what's interesting about this time is that the survivors are very, very vocal and actually seem to be remarkably adept at organizing. And so that is the difference. And so I don't think it's because the media, it's anything that the media has done specifically. It's coming from them. It's coming from them, and the media is covering it.
Well, and that's where it's like the chicken or the egg story, because, as we said earlier, the media wouldn't be covering it if there wasn't consumption, and there is consumption. And so for whatever reason, it's people stop and look at a car wreck, right? They put on their brakes instead of just keep on passing. For whatever reason, as a human being, we're attracted to that spectacle. I don't think we're ever going to change that, because I think that's always been. But maybe what you were talking about just a little bit ago is more important. Rather than focusing on the perpetrator, we're talking about the tragedy. Yes. And maybe that's the difference in this occurrence and occasion, that we're talking about the travesty and the lives and the suffering. And I think it's being driven by the humans, the teenagers, who have been emboldened and empowered to have a voice, unlike anybody has done before. Well, Columbine, we didn't know what to do, right? Columbine kind of started it. Sandy Hook, they were so young. And now we finally have folks that are of age, that are articulate and are outraged and do want to say something. I think that's what is galvanizing this story this time, and maybe hopefully moving forward.
Well, you know, now that the two of you point this out, I can tell you, I know a lot of more about Adam Lanza, who was the guy that was in the Newtown shooting, involved in the Newtown shooting, than we know about this person. I mean, now I hadn't noticed that, but now that you mention it, I really don't know a lot about this perpetrator. We know more about the victims in this case, and maybe that is a positive thing. And I don't know how we what we do from a policy standpoint to make that more the case than it's been in the past.
I love the fact that you are in the field of politics, because you raise questions that I don't think the average person would in this discussion with Dr. Towers. But I'm wondering if it's not legislation that we need, that it's more awareness, or Dr. Towers, you seem to suggest that mental health isn't really as much as a contributor as it is access to guns.
No one certainly perpetrates these acts without having a problem with mental illness. And while they may not have been officially adjudicated mentally ill, so you can certainly point to past perpetrators who were not officially diagnosed as mentally ill, clearly nobody perpetrates one of these acts without having some kind of mental illness. Like, I'm certain that if you're go into your health provider and say that you were planning on shooting up a school, you would very quickly get a diagnosis of mental illness. And you're not going to be leaving there without a diagnosis of mental illness. So even though many of them actually do not have a prior diagnosis, does not mean that they weren't. So that doesn't mean that mental illness does not play a role. It does. But whether or not that's the dominant, and certainly remember when I was telling you about the stage of the actor shooter, mental health, access to mental health resources can intervene in the earliest stage of these things. But when it comes down to it, what exact policies would be implemented with respect to mental health that would prevent these things? Certainly there is, for instance, laws to prevent people who have been adjudicated mentally ill, to prevent them getting firearms. But again, many of these people have not been actually officially adjudicated to be mentally ill.
In the
system.
So
what policies, concrete policies, does the government actually suggest that would actually be effective in reducing gun violence? I mean, because it's always brought up we should have the focus on mental illness, but then no specific policies are ever brought forward as to what exactly that means. Mm-hmm. Is it going to be, universal health care that would help, everybody, regardless of financial means, to get access to the care that they need? That's never brought up as such, but what exactly is meant by that? But it's more than just the mental health, because like I say, Canada, which does have universal access to health care, does have pretty much the same prevalence of mental illness than the U.S. does. But
not the level of gun violence.
Yeah, but not nearly the level of gun violence that the U.S. does. And the biggest difference is, I think, between the two societies, because I've lived in both of them, is that Canada has strict limits on magazine capacity. in Canadian society, which is, this is never going to fly in American society, but in Canadian society, you're also not allowed to carry around your firearm. So if you see somebody who's packing around a gun, you know, on a street in Canada, that person is generally up to no good. So that is one of the big differences between American and Canadian society. The American society is always going to have carry. I mean, that's just the way American society has evolved and the fundamental difference between the two countries. But this issue of magazine capacity, certainly it is a relatively recent thing that high-capacity firearms have become so popular in America. And so when you go back, I can't remember, I believe it was you, Senator Brown, who was saying that you grew up with guns, but you never had this problem when you were a kid with these,
right,
these issues. My guess is that none of the guns that you grew up with were high-capacity firearms.
Correct.
Well, that's true.
So, that's true. Michael, based on what she just said, what do you think about legislation, introduction thereof, starting with magazine capacity?
Well, obviously, that's something that has to be done, and they're talking about it right now with things like the bump stock and,
right,
you know, but it seems a little pusillanimous on my part with Congress that they're not addressing some of the more what I consider bigger problems with capacity, like large capacity magazines and things like that. Bump stock seems to be, to me, to be a very minor problem. I don't know that,
agree,
but that's the sense I get. And you know what? If mental illness, doctor, is a necessary but not sufficient condition for this violence, is there something in your statistical analysis that may lead to us being able to predict this somehow through the research you're doing? So, in other words, can we see who these people may be beyond just a mental profile of them?
Well, as I said, what our research found was that state levels of mental illness, state prevalence of mental illness, was not predictive of the state rate of these kinds of incidents. It was firearm ownership prevalence that was predictive. But one thing needs to be pointed out is that our research was not done at the personal level. It was kind of looking at the aggregate, you know, kind of looking at the temporal trends in these things. And I can't say, you know, from our research, specifically which events were inspired by contagion. All we can say is that we do see unusual bunching together in time, which is the hallmark of contagion. So you can never look at one specific event and say, oh, yeah, unless, of course, there was writings up. And indeed, some of these perpetrators do leave behind writings that, you know, show that they expressed fascination with Columbine or Newtown. And, you know, clearly there was some copycat effect, you know, at play there. But unless they actually leave something behind, we can't specifically point to one and say that one in particular was inspired by contagion. All we can say is that it really did follow soon on the heels of a similar tragedy.
So I'm going to suggest something here because, Michael, your question about that, about not necessary but sufficient, something known as the dark triad, which is a precursor to cyberbullying. So it incorporates three features, which is Machiavellianism, psychopathy, and narcissism. And I'm wondering if those three traits wouldn't be the same in a mass shooter. So Machiavellianism is somebody who manipulates, psychopathy is what we know it, and narcissism is, you know, they know everything, just ask them. Dr. Towers, has there been any research into that?
It may very well be, but the problem is that, say, if you look at the traits of the past perpetrators, you know, what did they have in common? And when you look at them, the vast majority were male. So should we look at all males as being a risk factor? Well, of course not, because 50% of the population is male. Basically, all of them were firearm owners. So should we look at firearm owners? Well, no, of course not, because there's a large fraction percentage of the population that owns firearms, and they're never going to perpetrate a crime. And so you look at mental illness. Well, yes, clearly, even if they weren't, like I was mentioning, advocated mentally ill, clearly mental illness played a role. But there are, you know, millions of mentally ill people in the United States who will never hurt anybody. So the problem in trying to predict, you know, exactly who will perpetrate these kinds of incidents such that you can hone in on them and prevent it is extraordinarily difficult. In this most recent case, it actually should not have been that difficult because there was lots and lots of warning signs that were flags put up by people who knew this kid. So in this particular case, it should not have come as a surprise to anybody what happened. But when you look at a lot of the other perpetrators of events, like, for instance, with the Newtown, could anybody have known that Adam Lanza would have perpetrated that, could have predicted it just from, the way he was? I'm sure that there's lots of people out there who have very similar personality profiles to Adam Lanza who will never perpetrate, a massacre. So that's one of the horrible, I guess, complexities of this problem, is that they're rare events, and yet they're the common denominators, or many of the common denominators to the perpetrators, unfortunately, are also common to a large enough fraction of the population that you can't really single those people out, because the vast majority of them are never going to perpetrate one of these acts.
Well, let me just say, Maria, that Machiavellianism and narcissism are two of the qualities that every politician has. So, yet you've got to be a Machiavellianist and a narcissist. But let me also ask you, Doctor, about a cultural thing, because all these guys are white too, isn't it? Have we ever had an African-American mass shooter?
Yes.
Oh, we have.
Yep. So we're actually in the midst of an analysis now where we're looking at the individual perpetrators of these mass shootings and looking at, again, for this thing, we're trying to determine whether or not there is some factor which may be predictive of, why they, the type of people who do this. And so we look at things like their race, their age, their gender, whether or not they've had military experience, whether or not they're immigrants. And what we find is that, the racial demographics of these shooters, once you exclude terrorist events, the racial demographics of these perpetrators are really the American averages. They're no different than the American averages. And when you look at, they're no more likely to have military experience. They're far more likely to be male. There's very few female perpetrators of these kinds of events. But yes, there has been, to answer your question, there has been black perpetrators. There's been Asian perpetrators, white perpetrators, of course. Native Indian perpetrators as well on occasion. But like I say, the racial and ethnic mixture is no different than the American averages. So that is not explanatory of what are risk factors to carry out one of these events.
Well, Doctor, we're running out of time here, but I want to give you the opportunity. Is there a website or someplace that people can go to find out more information on the kind of thing you're doing and maybe even support your work?
So our work, actually, if you just Google contagion and mass killings, I think our paper is one of the first links that pops up.
Okay.
There certainly has been a lot written about our work. So certainly if you were to Google those terms, you will find a lot of stuff that has been written about our work. I think one of the things that I would like to stress is that currently I am one of the very few researchers in the U.S. who's looking into this. And the reason I'm one of the very few is because there's this lack of federal funding. And it's a serious impediment to actually trying to understand what the dynamics really are that underlie this big, big problem in the United States, such that we can begin to have some idea of how to control it. And so if people were looking for, a way that they can perhaps help, lobbying their representative to basically demand that the Congress start funding firearm violence research would be a huge, huge step in the right direction.
Well,
help, Michael.
Yeah, you have a new friend in Washington, D.C., Dr. Towers. I don't have in the Senate, but anything I can do to help you.
But I'm asking, Michael, what do you think you could do with the circles that you run in?
Well, we might be able to do exactly what the doctor said, lobby for what that's worth, lobby our representatives. We have very, very tough gun laws here in the District of Columbia. We don't have a carry law. We don't have, we've got tough gun laws. So this is something that for a long time we've, you know, taken a stand on, but it really has to come from the states too. You really, everybody needs to put pressure on their representatives, because those are the people they respond to. And, you know, the funny thing is, people out there that are listening, a congressional office gets 50 phone calls takes notice. It doesn't take thousands and thousands and thousands of people. You get 50 phone calls to a representative's office, and they take notice of the issue. And that little receptionist that answers the phone, whoever that may be, he or she makes note of each phone call. So they know the calls that are coming in. So, maybe we can help put together a program where people can call in to the representatives, because that might be helpful.
Well, because the point that you're making, Dr. Towers, is important, in that we can't tell you why, because we don't have the money, because we haven't had the research into why. Because of this 20-year, I think it is, sanction against funding. And that came out in the news this week. So to me, it's almost like, well, we can get the information if we'd pay for it. So let's do it.
Yes,
and
absolutely.
And really, it's not really an expensive, I mean, it's not, you know, compared to, you know, the amount of funding that would go to cancer, for instance, it would be a tiny amount compared to that. But it really has dried up a lot of the research into firearm violence. And if this is something that, it's certainly something that I think a lot of lobbying needs to be done. And it's really not happening, I don't think. The lobbying that's basically saying, you know, we have to direct some money towards research in order to really get a sense of how to solve this problem.
Well, you know what?
Or understand it.
You know, I know somebody that's got a lot of money and an interest in this, and that's the National Rifle Association. Maybe they should fund the research, because they're always talking about how it's not guns. So, maybe they need to pony up a little money and show their good faith.
Well, the tobacco industry has had to, and the alcohol industry has had to. Why shouldn't the NRA?
Yeah. Absolutely. Well, on that note, we're going to have to leave it. But Dr. Towers, thanks so much for being with us. And I hope you'll come back, because there's so much more that we need to talk about. And you've been such an interesting guest. So thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for your eloquence.
Yes.
Really riveting.
You've been great. And we're going to leave you with a song now from our favorite son here in Washington, Marvin Gaye. And this goes out to Dr. Sherry Towers. What's going on? Folks, listen to the lyrics and let's all call our representative and get Dr. Towers some money for her research. Thank you. See you next week.
There's too many of you crying. Brother, 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 there's far too many.
Representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote.